From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. There's nothing new about our nation's long fight to make public education better for all. From big national efforts like No Child Left Behind and Common Core down to bitter battles in town meetings and lawsuits in some 45 states across the country. And last week, a Connecticut judge issued a searing takedown of his state's education system and demanded a total overhaul plan on his desk within 180 days. This hour on Point, the latest push for quality and equality in America's public schools. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Could this judge be talking about your state, your town? When do we say enough and really educate equally? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from the State Capitol Building in Hartford, Connecticut, is Daniela Altimeri. She covers state politics and government for the Hartford Current and has been following the court ruling. Daniela, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
Who was this judge? And give us a sense of just how scathing his takedown of Connecticut's education system has been.
Yeah, the takedown, which is a great way to describe it, was really extraordinary. He is essentially top to bottom overhaul from pre-K to high school graduation. He addressed everything in this 90-page ruling, which he read from the bench verbatim. Took about 3 hours, not including the hour for lunch, which was in itself quite extraordinary. Read it word for word. It took a lot of people here by surprise.
Introduce us to the judge, the Superior Court Judge Thomas, how do you say, Mukauscher?
Yes, he was appointed by the governor, former legislator himself. He's from the Connecticut shoreline, and he handles sort of complex litigation for the state and the state courts. And, he's been reviewing this case for a while now. It's been going on for 11 years, so there were other judges that were involved in this, but it's, you know, landed on his desk sort of near the conclusion, and really quite extraordinary.
It's about money. It's about the quality of education. It's about the state's duty to deliver a quality education. This was last Wednesday. Connecticut Superior Court Judge Thomas Mukauscher reading from that 89-page document. 3 hours he took to read it from the bench. Here's just a bit.
Beyond a reasonable doubt, Connecticut is defaulting on its constitutional duty to provide adequate public school opportunities because it has no rational, substantial, and verifiable plan to distribute money for education aid and school construction.
Money, education, the quality of education. And then he delivered this requirement of the state. Get it done. Propose reforms consistent with this huge opinion within 180 days. Here was the judge.
To get rid of an irrational policy and adopt a rational one. It's the court's job to require the state to have one. It's the state's job to develop one. The court will judge the state's solutions, and if they meet the standards described in this decision, uphold them. The state will submit proposed reforms consistent with this opinion within 180 days.
Wow. Daniela Altimeri is with the Hartford Current. She's in the state's capital right now. Give us a sense of just how sweeping and scathing this ruling was, Daniela.
Yeah, I mean, it was so broad, and it delved into so many different aspects of public education. I mean, you know, funding was at its core, and most people were expecting it to be about funding. And he certainly did talk about funding issues, although he did not prescribe a funding mechanism or a minimum funding or anything like that. He basically told the legislature, you guys have 180 days to figure it out. But it really, funding was just one piece of it. I mean, he addressed everything from the way teachers are compensated in the state, the way teacher evaluations are done, whether or not there should be a high school graduation requirement. I mean, there were so many aspects to this that funding wound up being just one piece.
Was the heart of it about quality of education or equality or inequality?
I think the heart of it was about quality and about the state's responsibility to develop a fair and thoughtful way of providing education to all of its students, wealthy and poor alike.
Of course, property taxes are involved in Connecticut, as all across this country, in funding education. But you've also got a lot of state funding for education. He was very scathing about how that state funding, which I guess is supposed to equalize what is almost by definition in unequal property tax revenues, about how the state funding is distributed.
Yeah, he basically, his ruling at its core found that the funding formula that the state uses is haphazard and arbitrary, and in his words, it leaves rich districts to flourish and poor ones to flounder. That was sort of at its core. These are not new issues in Connecticut or in other states. This idea that there's this broad disparity among wealthy and poor districts is, you know, something that's been evident for many years. Our paper did a big series about the two Connecticuts, the wealthy and the poor, you know, 20 years ago, and really very little has changed. So a lot of people are saying here that this ruling will perhaps light a fire on these issues and really motivate people to start making some changes.
Daniela, is Connecticut substantially worse than other states around the country when it comes to unequal education?
Well, I'm not sure if it's substantially worse. I do know that Connecticut has some of the nation's best schools. I mean, some of the wealthier districts in the state routinely make the top lists of, you know, the best schools in the country. Public education here is very, very, very good in many communities. But in other communities, particularly the state's largest cities, it's really facing some very profound issues. And I think that disparity is very sharply etched here, where maybe in other states it's not quite as there's not quite as big a gulf.
The judge went after the way the state takes state revenues to that's supposed to even out the inequalities. He said it's sometimes working just the opposite. Here he was again reading from his decision.
The state spends billions of dollars on schools without any binding principle guaranteeing that education aid goes where it's needed. During the recent budget crisis, this left rich schools robbing millions of dollars from poor schools.
And he did not just go after legislators and how the money was coming down. He went after teachers and how they're evaluated. Here he called the teacher evaluation system in Connecticut essentially a farce.
State's teacher evaluation system is little more than cotton candy in a rainstorm. Everything about it suggests it was designed to give only the appearance of imposing a significant statewide evaluation standard. These empty evaluation guidelines mean good teachers can't be recognized and bad teachers reformed or removed.
Daniela Altamari covers all this for the Hartford Courant. Daniela, how is the state legislature supposed to respond to basically a top-to-bottom, wall-to-wall critique of the system in 6 months, 180 days?
Yeah, many people are saying it's going to be impossible. The legislature, like probably most legislative bodies, moves fairly slowly, and the types of reforms that he is ordering up are certainly sweeping and very broad. And most people are saying, these are, again, problems that have been evident for many, many years, and the idea that this is going to be solutions are going to be devised in 180 days is, some people are saying, not realistic.
Wait a minute. It sounds like you're folding the tent already when this judge is just taking this bold stand. Is that the attitude? He can say whatever he wants, but we can't respond to it? We don't have the oomph?
The question is, you know, whether the state will appeal it, and I think that will be evident in the near future. The attorney general defended the state in this case, and they have the option to appeal it. And obviously, if they do appeal it, it would buy the state some time.
Is there some cudgel that he holds over the state if they don't win an appeal and they don't get it done in 180 days, at least lay out a plan? Is there some penalty?
Well, he has the power of the court behind him. But, you know, again, this has been dragging on for 11 years. So he certainly has a sense of urgency, and he laid out very well why this urgency is needed. But whether or not the legislature or the State Department of Education or the state in general responds to that urgency remains to be seen.
Daniela, stand by. We've got right with us now from Hartford, Connecticut as well, Andy Fleischman. He's a Democratic state rep in Connecticut, represents West Hartford. He's co-chair of the Connecticut Legislature's Education Committee. Representative Fleischman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Can you lay out a reform plan for Connecticut schools at the depth required by this judge in 180 days?
Well, I don't accept that that's the question before us today. This ruling was quite unexpected, as Daniela pointed out, for me, because the plaintiffs went to court questioning whether the state was providing adequate support for education in Connecticut. So that had to do with the overall level of funding. And in his decision, Judge McCousher essentially punted on that question and said, well, you know, it's hard to say what adequacy is. The state Supreme Court set a basic standard that's pretty low, so I'm not going to question the legislature's or the executive branch's decision about how much money overall is put into education. Rather, I do have questions about the formula that's used for allocating those dollars.
To put it mildly, he said, you recently left rich schools robbing millions of dollars from poor schools. Is that what you set up, Representative Fleischman?
No, that's a mischaracterization from someone who doesn't understand the current formula. So the current formula was formulated pursuant to a Supreme Court decision in 1977, Horton v. Meskill. And that decision said town wealth disparities must be focal to what is the state allocation decision, and the student needs also have to be taken into account. So we have a formula that takes into account the student census, the grand list, which is the town wealth, and attempts to distribute funds that way. Over the course of the last 10 years, virtually all of our decisions have been to dedicate more dollars to those communities with the least wealth, and to delegate more dollars to those communities with the greatest need, as demonstrated by what's happening with their student achievement.
And yet, overall, he comes in and says, as scathingly, this is not working. You've got a dysfunctional system and deep inequality. Are you saying he's wrong?
I do believe there's deep inequality that needs to be addressed. But the plaintiffs who showed up, who said, is the level of funding adequate?
Yep.
Are they going to say this ruling is fine with them when the ruling from this judge essentially says, okay, I'm not going to question the overall level of funding, but I want you to modify the formula. That means it's a zero-sum game, so that while some superintendents and mayors may be saying, oh, I like this ruling, I think I see more resources coming.
Others won't. Representative Fleischman, stand by. We have to take a short break right here. We'll come right back to you. Want to hear more? Daniel Altemeyer with the Hartford Courant, stand by as well. We're looking at a tough ruling on education in America, in Connecticut. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the latest tough push from the courts to bring fairness, quality, equality to American public schools. It's out of Connecticut, where they've been given 180 days by a state judge to shape up, but it really speaks to the whole country. You can join us this hour. What do you think? What are you hearing in this story? Are we nationally still ignoring a problem of educational inequality? Could that Connecticut judge be speaking to the whole country when he says we've, quote, left districts to rich districts to flourish and poor districts to flounder? Will it always be this way when we pay for schools with property taxes? What's the big answer here? It was Judge Thomas Mukauscher delivered this ruling last week, 89 pages. He read the whole thing from the bench. It was tough, went way beyond what he was asked to rule on. As my guest Andy Fleischman points out, he's co-chair of the legislature's Education Committee in Connecticut. Daniela Altemari is with us as well from the Hartford, Connecticut, covering this. Here was the judge saying, nothing in this huge ruling is done lightly or blindly.
Nothing here was done lightly or blindly. The court knows what its ruling means for many deeply ingrained practices. But it also has a marrow-deep understanding that if they are to succeed where they are most strained, schools have to be about teaching children and nothing else.
And there's been all kinds of response. Here was the mayor of Waterbury, Connecticut, Neil O'Leary, hailing the ruling, said he applauded the coalition of teachers groups and mayors and others who had fought this case through the state's courts for 11 years.
I commend all the people behind this for the great work that they've done. We've all long understood the disparity in education in Connecticut. Today, simply put, is a huge victory for impoverished, challenged, and disabled children in the state of Connecticut.
Many countries around the country can look on and nod with understanding. Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts is calling right now. Bill, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. This judge was right on the mark. Thank God for his ruling, and it's long overdue, not just simply in the state of Connecticut, but throughout the nation. We're stronger as a nation the better better educated we are. And this judge really tapped into what's wrong with the whole system and how we fund education.
Bill, I'm sure a lot of people would nod along with that and wonder where we go from here. Andy Fleischman, it's in your lap to do something about it. Are you going to just Are you going to fight this? Are you going to are you urging the Attorney General to appeal? Are you going to take it seriously and work on a new design?
Well, first, let me say the issues at hand I take seriously. I think anyone who cares about the children in our school systems takes seriously. And I agree with your caller, Bill. These are important issues. But to go to the quote that you had from the mayor of Waterbury, so for every mayor or superintendent who is making a statement like that, there are probably two or three who are right now quietly worrying about the import of this decision.
Why?
Because by failing to say that there is some way of determining what is an adequate level of state support for education in the state of Connecticut
overall,
and sort of punt overall and punting on that, while simultaneously saying redo the formula, he creates a situation where there are going to be winners and losers. Add to that this fact that the state of Connecticut still has an incredible financial crunch it's facing.
Yeah.
We made major cuts last year. There are probably more cuts to come this year. There's a projected deficit of over $800 million. So we face a specter, if this decision were to go forward without any challenge, where overall spending on education could be pushed down further in the budget crisis, with some districts like Bridgeport or Waterbury getting more and many districts getting far less. So it's not evident that overall you'd see better results for Connecticut children in that scenario.
When you say winners and losers, do you mean that wealthier communities would lose and poorer communities would win in a redistribution?
I think that's the case, but that doesn't concern me as much as communities in the middle, communities like the one I serve, where we've got, say, 35% of students who are minority students. We've got a larger number of that who are on free and reduced price lunch. We have a larger number still who are coming from homes where English is the second language. So there's tremendous amounts of need. And our current education cost sharing formula actually takes those types of need into account, because it's very challenging for a district to meet the needs of all those diverse students. This decision doesn't really speak to that. It speaks to another factor, which is important, but the Supreme Court has never spoken to it independent of Judge McCousher. Judge McCousher is focused on what are the educational attainments of the students in the districts.
Yep.
Now, we've been looking at that, and all of the increases you've seen in the last decade in funding for education in Connecticut have really focused on the districts with the greatest need. And we've also put conditions. We've said, here are additional dollars. Show us your turnaround plans. It's not as simple as it looks on its face. Just an example of that. The judge was very critical of what happens in special education. He questioned special education dollars going to children with profound needs and lack of clarity and how much they would progress.
Yeah.
Well, his opinion runs counter to federal law. The Americans with Disabilities Act says that you can't go ahead and defund a child because you think that their disabilities reach a certain level. So there are lots of aspects of this decision that we still are digesting, but it's not evident to me that in criticizing the system, the judge is appropriate in treating an entire title of our statutes as an etch-a-sketch, which he can shake and say, okay, it's a blank slate. I'd like you to redraw it and bring it back to me.
Daniela Altamirano, we've just got you and the representative for another minute here. What do you see happening? The judge brings down this huge hammer. The state, what, appeals? The state says, no, things go on pretty much as before. What do you see coming, Daniela? You're the reporter here.
Well, the state certainly has the right to appeal, and I think we'll find out in a few days whether or not they will. I mean, one thing I think is that will happen is this coalition that was behind this lawsuit, that brought this lawsuit, very diverse coalition, Yale University students, education reform types, municipalities, and teachers' unions. I think you'll see a real fracture in that coalition, because there were certainly elements of the judge's ruling that, for instance, the teachers' union were really taken aback by. For instance, the evaluation, his comments on teacher evaluation, and his call for a sweeping change in the way teachers are compensated. That wasn't something that the teachers' union had signed on to. They didn't see that as part of this. So I think you'll see a breakdown in the groups that were sort of united on the funding question but have very different constituencies and very different ideas of how to fix the system.
A judge who's just stepped in with a nearly 90-page ruling carrying nobody's water, maybe his own, we'll see see what Connecticut does with it. The whole country is watching. Daniela Altamari with the Hartford Current, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Andy Fleischman, he is a representative from West Hartford, co-chair of the Education Committee. Good luck to you, Representative Fleischman.
Thank you very much for your time and for covering this important issue.
Happy to do it. With me right now in the studio is Preston Green, professor of educational leadership and law and of urban education at the University of Connecticut's NEAG School of Education. Preston Green, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you see at the heart of what just happened here? Is this a citizen judge standing up and saying, we've got a total mess, we need a whole new formula, Connecticut's got its head in the sand and it's not fair? Is it? Has he misread his own state? What just happened in this kind of epic ruling?
Yes, I think that when I heard the judge's ruling, I was very surprised. The ruling is very sweeping. Not only does the judge talk about funding, the judge talks about educational standards, also talks about teacher evaluation and the tension between special education and general education. This is very sweeping.
Tension in that special education takes resources, and those are also needed in general education, so it's
yes,
just built in.
Yes, that is correct, yes.
Sweeping in a knowing way, in a way, is he speaking to a genuine Connecticut problem, maybe the genuine American problem when it comes to education?
Well, there's one issue that I do want to talk about that was not covered in the previous segment, and this goes to your question, and that is mm-hmm. sort of like, what is the standard for education? And as everyone had said before, said that the standard had been met. However, the judge said that the standard had to be not just high school graduation, but actual attainment, educational attainment, preparation for college.
It is good performance on, good exams.
On good exams. And students in school districts such as Windham, Bridgeport, are not meeting that standard. And so he was asking for funding that could actually be related to achieving that goal.
What's wrong with that? I mean, isn't that what equal education would mean, that we bring forward the resources to give all of our young citizens a fair shot?
Oh, there's nothing wrong with that. I think that what he wanted to do was to have the state focus on that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so that certainly is a clarion call.
What do you do with a call like that? We've had so many efforts already, No Child Left Behind, Common Core. I mean, years and years, decades of reform efforts. Is he just whistling in the wind here, or do we have a set of tools that we just haven't pulled out of the toolbox?
Well, there's going to be conflict. Let's face it. These issues bring up conflict between the legislature and the judiciary. And legislatures are made up of people who represent their constituents. And so there's going to be conflict in that some constituents are not going to be for this. And so
you mean if they feel that their community may be asked to give up some state resources for poorer communities?
Yeah, they may be asked to give up their education to poor communities, but also that education is seen as a way of having an advantage, a way of giving certain folks opportunities that others do not have.
I worked hard to make a good living to get into this community where we have these good schools.
Right.
Now that's my prize.
I don't want to center it. And it's understandable why that would be. But there is – that the courts have to find a way to have a school – you know, a constitutional system that benefits all and that gives the poorest among us the opportunity to have an – to have educational advantages later on down the road.
So he saw this financing system as unconstitutional. Preston Green, stand by. Callers here. Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks. I come to the discussion with a master's in education, and it seems like if there's unequal funding, then that's unfair, and it would seem that there's an X amount of dollars, X amount of students, and the state, the education department should be able to fairly quickly come up with a formula to redistribute that. And, you know, if certain more wealthy school districts, want a certain higher funding, you know, they can raise more taxes and help transfer that wealth into some poorer districts. That's all I want to say. I'll just listen. Thanks.
Paul, I appreciate your call. Preston, take the population of students and then, you know, divide the revenue available by that number, distribute equally across, and then let communities do what they will on the other side of that. Make sense or not?
It makes some sense. I want to tweak that a little bit, and that is that one has to – you have to consider the differential needs of the districts and also the different needs of the students. And so you do need to take into account the fact that certain school districts may have greater needs, and thus the distribution may end up being different.
Because they have more challenging
social circumstances. Because they have more challenging social circumstances
and
economic stances. That is circumstances. That is correct.
It's never quite simple here. David in Stowe, Vermont. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. In Vermont, I can speak that we've done most of what the current call speaker is talking about. We've equalized funding. We've tilted it even further so students who live in poverty get a little bit more due to how they count students. So you pay independent of your local tax base. Yet that happened 20 years ago. The legislature is not satisfied with that because of continued educational outcome diversity. The more well-to-do communities like Stowe continue to do well despite shipping the majority of the tax revenue out to equalize other communities' education.
So what has Vermont taken away from that experience, David, or what do you?
Well, you know, we as a community, I can speak to my local community, we accepted that burden. Now it's just part of how we look at life. Now the legislature is potentially making us merge with another district, and we have to prove that retaining our local school district would be better for everybody, including neighboring districts, as opposed to their preferred system. So my comment is that funding is one part of it, but you have to also watch out that people who do have, you know, worthy goals could, you know, destroy local communities and their rights to, you know, want to do things, you know, despite the burdens of this funding equality.
Yeah, David, I appreciate your call. Professor Green, the judge was tough on the local focus here. He said, like, the state has to get in here and be more active in equalizing. But you hear David, Vermont equalized 20 years ago, and they've still got inequalities. And he's worried about what happens to local communities who may have resources, really care about their kids, don't want to see that quality diminished.
Right. And I understand that concern. I definitely do. My response to that is, especially what happened in Connecticut, is that the court system, the judiciary, has to make sure that the state provides an educational system that benefits all, and that it takes into account the concerns of local control, but at the same time make sure that, like, local control does not become an excuse not to address the concerns of all.
Throw up our hands and say, nothing we can do is in local hands.
Right. And so, that's why the judge looked at the funding system and said that, you know, while there is local control, that does not excuse the state from providing an education that not only benefits some local school districts, but all.
Do people even know how, if they wanted to take his ruling seriously and have a new design in 180 days, if you could have the wisest people in the world come, or the country, the world, I don't know, sit down and look at Connecticut's problem, is there a clear formula for how to do this? Is it an American blindness that we've got here, a Connecticut blindness? Is it? Surely it's possible.
Well, I think that a system that that can accomplish this, that may be somewhat unpopular, would be one that focuses the resources more in terms of those school districts that need it the most. And so you may have a system such that where not everyone gets something, but that those that are in the greatest need get the greatest funding.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the latest tough push from the courts to bring fairness, quality, equality to American public schools. It comes out of Connecticut, where they've been given 180 days by a state judge to shape up, but it speaks really to the whole country and its problem we know that we have. It's interesting, a lot of talk about class and race, racism. Over the weekend, we heard Rachel Martin on Weekend Edition, NPR's Weekend Edition, talking with Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas, the singer, about how our country has cost some dearly by not focusing on educating all our young. He said maybe not personal racism anymore, but something like structural racism. Here's the artist Will.i.am with his take.
It's really not racism. It's really just like this system that's in place that we just have to look at it, because the same folks that are filling up them prisons are the same folks that we neglected their education on. And it just so happens to be black people. So yes, from that perspective, Black Lives Matter. But all lives matter. All lives to pay attention to this system that we have to just like untangle.
It's the system, says Will.i.am, the singer. If you can pay for education or you can pay for prisons, he's kind of saying there. Connecticut, looking at its education issues right now, the whole country knows that this is an American problem. Does this resonate in your state, your town? Preston Green is with us, professor of education, leadership, and law at the University of Connecticut's NEAG School of Education. Professor Green, stand by. With us right now as well from Halls, Tennessee, is Jerry Wiest. He was one of the nation's longest-serving superintendents, drew national attention as superintendent of Maryland's Montgomery County School District for closing the achievement gap there in his county's schools. Jerry Wiest, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad a judge didn't tiptoe around the tulips anymore.
He surely did not. Almost 90 pages of really whacking them. I don't know how deeply you've dipped into this, Jerry, but when you see a broadside, you know, just scathing critique like this, are you saying, well...
I'm happy because it brought the attention of the country to the issue. The issue is about race. It is about quality. It is about equality. We have the same issue with equality of incomes. We have the same issue with housing. We have the same issue. The person who just spoke before about prisons, he's absolutely right. States size their prison population by third grade reading scores all over the country.
So what do you do?
Shocking, isn't it?
Well, I mean...
Well, what do you do is that we've got to bring back our American way of egalitarianism. We've gone too far where we've divided the inequality has gotten greater. And one of the reasons the person from Vermont was calling that it's got a problem because it's tried it is the problem is growing faster than we've been able to address it. The children of the recession are marching into K-1, 2, and 3 grades across the country.
So?
And they're bigger in number, they're poorer, and they're more diverse than they've ever been before.
Is equalizing revenues the number one goal? Do you have to go further than equalizing, as Professor Green?
Oh, you have to go much further. I thought the judge did a great job. First of all, you've got to set the outcome that you want to achieve. And I think that should be college and career ready. And from that, because that's just like a mountain, and that mountain grows every year because it just takes more every year. You've got to change the parameters of time, because time has stayed constant since my mother was in school in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And still 180 days, mostly across six-hour days. So we kept time constant, but we increased quality. The next mountain that you have to climb is the college mountain. So you need to have your outcome when you graduate that you're more college-ready than you have been before. You can make choices. You can go to the military. You can go to other areas of the country, but work areas pay very well, actually. So college and career, both. But those outcomes of what you need to know and how you need to be a continuous learner are the same. You reverse engineer that on your time scale, just like you were setting up a pathway up the mountain all the way down to the foot of the mountain, which would be preschool, actually birth. Parents who went to college or have attained high career status know that pathway. The child who has parents who are working many jobs, care about their children just as much, has an equal chance, probably starts miles away from the foot of the mountain. So you've got to have an early childhood program that ties into your extended day program, that ties into your school district program, that has guideposts and mileposts all the way up. Then you have to fund accordingly. You have to do differential staffing. You have to do differential funding. You have to, take a look at all aspects of it. You certainly can't rob from special education because those children, autism is growing at an exponential rate. There's many children that need that kind of help. So you have to have increased funding. But you also, and he addressed this, has to have a strong teacher evaluation system. You have to weed and feed those teachers and listen to them and help them get into a collaborative governance model that helps you solve the problem.
Can we afford to follow the path that you're describing as a country?
We can't afford not to, Tom. Our country's at risk. You talk about huge risk from outside powers. You talk about fear of attacks. You talk about all of those kinds of issues. One of the biggest risks we have is an inequality in education, because we are growing a population of students who are poor, more diverse, and more different races than we've ever grown in the United States history. You're not going to solve this by tiptoeing around the tulips. So, yes, I don't agree that with all of the judge's ruling, but I do agree he hit some of the very high points that need to be hit. Now, teachers want to do this. The reason we made very strong gains in Montgomery County, both in graduation rates and preparation rates,
yes,
is that our teachers actually work together because they can help redistribute those resources internally. They want high quality. They want to weed out poor performers, and they want the feeding or otherwise the development embedded, just like we have in other professions, to give them the strength of numbers and cohesion and a coherent plan all the way up.
You say they want to do it, but you know, Jerry, we said often teachers, some teachers are represented as, you know, just kind of coasting and feeling invulnerable to real assessment and asleep
at
the switch.
The biggest thing that is happening in our country is teacher isolation. I mean, they're given little time. They're given lots of programs. Everybody comes in and tells them what to do. They close the door, and they're faced with large numbers in their class, and they don't have any professional development. You have to have strategies to overcome that, and you can.
Preston Green, I want to come to you on this. Jerry Weiss, it's great to have you with us. Stand by. We've got callers from all over the place. Michael in Austin, Texas. You're on the air, Michael. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, in Texas, we have a similar funding mechanism where we, based on property taxes, you know, it goes district by district, and it certainly ends up with an equal or unequal funding. And I've given some thought to this, and I think that rather than using property taxes to fund education, we should replace that with a larger statewide sales tax, and then take all of that money, apportion it evenly based on something like student body population, and then you have the added benefit of actually addressing a much larger, in my opinion, issue that you've addressed on your show, which is gentrification.
So scrap the property tax, go to a sales tax, distribute it equally. We've already heard that even if you distribute it equally, you may still have problems because different communities start at different places. Preston Green.
Well, equal treatment is the most unequal treatment that you can give, Tom. You know, every parent knows that has more than one child. Because some children require more, you know, two scoops of sugar, will.
Yeah. Preston Green, Connecticut has tried already. I mean, they've got a state program that's supposed to come in and do this equalizing.
Well, let me touch on some of this.
Yes,
and
please.
I really do want to. The present speaker is really making a great point about the elephant in the room, and that is the issues with race. Connecticut has one of the largest racial achievement gaps in the country.
Is that right?
That is correct. And it's also, I should also point out that I do a lot of research in this area with Bruce Baker out of Rutgers University, school finance expert. And a lot of our research looks at the issues of race, and that there is this squeamishness about dealing with these issues, especially the concerns faced with African Americans head on. For instance, we've talked a little bit about teacher evaluation and about providing good quality teachers. There's research to suggest that it may be very difficult to get teachers into communities with large percentages of African Americans. So there has to be some inducement, some way of attracting these teachers into
Can I butt in?
Communities.
Yeah, Jerry, what do you think there?
I want a practitioner here, okay?
Okay.
First of all, we had African Americans graduate and get a 3 or better on the AP test, which gets them college ready. That is the best test to say that.
Yeah.
And we had a higher percentage of them taking the test than the rest of the nation, not African Americans, the whole nation, and our African Americans outscored the rest of the nation.
But every community has a different racial profile. Montgomery County may not be the same as some of the communities that Preston Green is describing.
In poverty, too. That was studied by the University of Chicago, Charles Payne.
I understand what he's saying.
What you have to do is differentiate class size. You have to start with early childhood education so children can get that early start. It has to be taught by high-quality early childhood teachers who make it fun because you have to both prepare and inspire. You have to have them reading by the end of kindergarten, just like kids do that come from more wealthy families. And then you have to carry that on up. And it has to be consistent throughout the entire climb up that mountain.
It's a long climb. We're looking at Connecticut. We're looking at the country. Yes, please. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Preston?
I don't think that we are in disagreement here, in fact. And in fact, there's research to suggest, for instance, that African-American students benefit from smaller class sizes. This is an intervention that has been found to benefit this group specifically in ways that are different than other groups.
Okay.
So that goes to the point that there may be approaches that may be more effective for some groups than others. And I still do not back away from the point that nationally speaking, there's research to suggest that that it may be difficult to attract teachers to certain districts. And so while there are instances where people have done great things, you cannot get past the fact that this is an issue that we need to address head on and just be honest about it.
Yeah, Jerry, how do you get teachers into the toughest districts where that may not be the most attractive on the face as workplaces?
You have to have an excellent principal. Teachers leave because they have poor leadership. B, you have to give them a class size that they think is doable. C, you have to be able to group and regroup. D, you have to change the culture, and you can only do that if you change the structure. F, the next is that you have to have a correlative kind of predictability model so they can see the guideposts along the way. I mean, if you were able to hit level 6 on reading recovery, you had about a 90% chance of being on grade level at second grade. That's what I'm talking about, having predictability. Then you have to surround them with lots of training, extra training, because you have to change the culture that we have educationally, that we are constant learners. Then you have to expand time with your after-school programs and before-school programs, and you have to extend time bound to early childhood. You have to go into housing projects, and mothers are your first and best teachers. Babies who are born in poverty are not born everywhere. You have to go to the pediatricians, the doctors surrounding it. There is a lot of good research that if you put it all together, it works. The proof of the pudding is I can show you districts across the country in Texas and other places that it has worked.
Then why don't we do it nationally? I mean, everybody can
because
see the problem.
We do not have the will, okay? We love to sort in our country, and we don't mind the variability as long as it doesn't affect our child. And it's the same thing with income inequality. It's very difficult to have egalitarianism at this level. And because we have units the size of small districts, it's hard to spread the peanut butter evenly over the piece of bread. I mean, Texas has got 1,000 school districts.
Yeah.
Connecticut's got 160 to more school districts.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Montgomery County, as a school district, would have equaled 25% to 30% of all students in Connecticut. We could spread the wealth around.
I've got a listener here in Illinois, I guess, who says, well, look at the bright side. At least Connecticut is not Illinois. This listener says we're 50th in equality in school funding. I don't know about that, but I know Illinois ranks pretty far down the list for equality. It says a suburban district gets a damn planetarium or Olympic-sized pool, and an urban district or small rural district has textbooks over 15 years old.
And Illinois also has some racial disparities, too.
Well, but yes, of course.
Illinois has 800 and some school units. And again, it's very difficult to spread that over.
How do we muster, let alone little Connecticut by comparison, how do we muster national will to get on top of this Preston Green?
I think that that is a very good question. And I think that what we have to understand is that there will always be this tension, and that when there is this pushback, that, you know, this may be difficult, we can't do this, we have to keep on trying. We just have to keep on trying.
The judge says try in a hurry.
Forum like the military had this past week, where you had they had a commander-in-chief forum. I think it's about time we got presidential candidates in front of a TV, and let's listen to educators, talk to them, and see if we can get some answers. Because it is a national problem, and it's going to really affect our quality of our jobs. And this is not just a moral argument. This is an economic argument.
If we don't get on top of it, Jerry Wiest, if Connecticut doesn't, if the country doesn't, what's the consequence?
Well, the consequences are is more and more inequality, which eventually will lead to what it's led to now, more and more anger, which will intensify as time goes along, because you've got 80 to 90% of the people being left off the train, which is going to cause our whole system of governance to be challenged.
Well,
we've got to start addressing this.
Look, on the bright side, if you do get on top of it, what a much more comfortable and happy country we might have. A challenge to Connecticut right now from the judge there to do it in 180 days. Jerry Wiest, joining us today from Halls, Tennessee. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Preston Green from the University of Connecticut's NEAG School of Education. Thank you so much, Professor Green.
And thank you so much for asking me to be here.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.